Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Each and every day, Monday through Friday, except in Washington, D.C. on WPFW, where it's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday evening, we bring information on how to improve the quality of our lives. And more than anything, I try to instill within each program hope, a sense of optimism that the future and the present can be better if we've learned some lessons. More often than not, people will make choices without always knowing what other alternatives there were to the choice that they made. People don't look to get sick. People don't want to be sick. Nobody wakes up in the morning and say, I'd like to be older and more wrinkled and impotent and incontinent and suffering from dementia. No. But the consequences of making the wrong choice can frequently put us there. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen overnight. If you ate something bad and immediately your system rebelled and you then were aware that that's something I shouldn't be consuming, that would be, quite simply, that would be better than what most people end up doing, which is taking things that are not good for them, but the body fights against what we've done. Cigarette smoke or fluoridated water, even the toxins in the air. And then one day, we simply start to break down. Our immune system collapses, and then we start seeing the manifestation of the disease. A classically defined disease is never classical in its initial stages. It's always a subclinical manifestation. That manifestation could be something as simple as the mucus on your tongue, the discoloration in your eye, the cracks in your nails, little white spots on the toenails, bad breath. It does not have to be a heart attack or a tumor or an arthritic joint or a blood sugar measured at 300 in order to define disease. We've never seen disease as a process. Our entire way of thinking about wellness and disease is in a quantum logic. And a quantum logic begs the idea that things simply appear without any process of how they appeared. It's like saying I'm either rich or poor. My gas tank is either full or empty. The house is either standing or collapsed. No, everything is a process in life, even in a relationship. I've been out of New York and will be out for another 2 weeks on the road and out of the country for most of that time. And no matter where I go, and it was kind of interesting, I never thought anyone would recognize me, since I've never been to some of the countries that I'm going to now, but I wasn't even aware that my television series has shown my hard-hitting documentaries, my investigative reporting series, has been shown in these countries and sent down by relatives, and then they circulate because they have very few means of being open to the larger community, and especially where there's any dissident. So since I'm considered by them a leading political dissident in the United States, it was as if a friend to a friend, even though you're strangers, because you both struggle for something in the way of social change. And when I'm speaking with these people, since they felt that there was some connection there, ideological connection certainly, when I would ask them about what they're doing about their health, consistently, they were unaware that the things they were doing were harmful. And when I brought to their attention that there's a reason why you have cancer and a reason why you have arthritis, where they would be extremely astute in understanding a lot of the minutia within a political or social paradigm, it's as if they were totally disengaged from using that same reasoning when it came to their own health. Not so different than many people in the United States. Not so different than people who will go to work every day and really master that effort. the process of achieving something of a high standard that they can be happy with and others of their work, and they will not allow the kind of compromised reasoning and logic that would cause them to fail or do a poor job. But when it comes to our health and even the interpersonal choices we make and the relationship choices, it's as if we've never learned a lesson and we're starting from square one. So that's where this program tries to take us. Every day we're having new listeners. Every day, people are coming across the Tao for the first time and joining people who've been listening. But not everybody learns from what they listen to. I've seen that more often than not. People saying, oh, I've been listening for 20 years. And then I look at them and they're smoking or drinking or they're a mess. And I think, what have you been listening to? It's about what we actualize in the end. What are we able to do in the way of a constructive change? So that's where our program begins. Now, in our journey, I'm going to be citing some of the stories and articles that generally do not get much press attention, and when they do, almost always there is a bias. And so we're really not aware, if we're the average American, of all the dynamics that a story really holds. And so I try to give a little perspective on that. And I will be taking calls today. Now, because of the technical difficulties, when I'm not in studio and I'm doing all this by a remote, I'm not able to take calls from our other syndicated stations around the country. So I'm going to stick just with the New York tri-state area, that anyone who can hear the show right now, and we're broadcasting live, not on tape, you can call 212-279-2900. That's 212-279-2900. And let me start by first thanking Francis Roberts of New Jersey for emailing me some information. I was out of email pocket for about 8 days, but just today I'm able to get some emails. Margarine, worse than butter, according to a Dutch study. This comes from Reuters in Washington. I'll quote it. The type of fat in margarine and vegetable oil reduces the function of blood vessels and drives down levels of the good cholesterol more than saturated fats such as those found in butter and meat, according to a study published. Researchers from the Netherlands sought to determine whether different diets play a role in the blood vessels' ability to dilate and expand. This function is impaired in patients with cardiovascular disease. They gave diets high in trans fatty acids, such as those in margarine, to one group of subjects, and diets high in saturated fats, such as those found in animal products and coconut and palm oil, to other subjects. They found that the ability of the blood vessels to dilate was nearly a third lower in people who ate the diet high in trans fatty acids, meaning margarine, compared to those who had saturated fats. In addition, blood levels of high-density lipoproteins, that's the good cholesterol, were about one-fifth lower in the trans fatty groups compared to the saturated fat. According to the head epidemiologist Nicole DeRose, an expert in human nutrition epidemiology, she said this might be part of the explanation why a diet high in trans fats increases the risk of coronary heart disease, unquote. And this was published in the journal Atherosclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology, which is published by the American Heart Association. Now, let me add my own addendum to this. This study is both good in the sense that it shows us that margarine is bad, but it's flawed in that they did not differentiate animal fats. And it's flawed because the fat, the arachidonic fat, found in animal proteins like meat and butter and milk, cheeses in general, and chicken, is different in how the body uses it in coconut oil or palm oil. I actually support the use of coconut oil. In point of fact, there are many studies showing that coconut oil and coconut fat is actually good for your heart. And in those cultures that use this, they have healthier hearts, even though they have a high percentage of saturated fats. So what this means is that not all saturated fats are equal, but in this study, they did not distinguish the difference in the type of saturated fat. That was the limitation of this study. And also saying hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated is also misleading. Trans fats are created when hydrogen atoms are forced into liquid oils, such as corn and soybean oil. The term hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated refers to this process. So when you start off with a with something that is liquid and you add hydrogen, you're going and you homogenize, you're going to end up with a solid. That's how they get margarine. That hydrogen creates this, the firmness in margarine or butter. That is not the same as how a that's bad. That's harmful. That'll clog your lard arteries, cause your blood to stick together, clump, which can lead to clots and thrombosis and stroke. That's not how coconut oil works. Coconut oil is naturally, without any partial hydrogenation or hydrogenation, it's a natural fat, because just like olive oil, which is a monounsaturated fat, put olive oil in the refrigerator, it turns to solid. Put coconut oil in the refrigerator, it turns to solid. But it also, in the body, it dissolves back into a liquid. So they have missed this whole dynamic in nutritional biochemistry. And that's part of the problem when you have someone doing a study who has only a background in epidemiology and a basic understanding of nutrition, but is not an expert in nutritional physiology or nutritional biochemistry. You end up with partial results, which is unfortunate because this is considered, you know, the top of the top of the American Heart Association or a journal like Atherosclerosis and Thrombosis Vascular Biology, which is a good journal and does some good work. But it shows you that even the best of the best are limited. But it is still the bottom line, don't eat margarine or meat. And this comes, and I don't know if this is simply a coincidence, which it, by the way, it can completely be a coincidence. But it also may be due to, from what I understand from several friends in Washington, D.C. and different agencies, they have been inundated, including at the FDA, over the last 6 months when we were doing our series on Prozac and Ritalin and the harmful effects that were not on the labels. And from what I understand, there have been thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these serious questions raised by phone, fax, emails. And there are a lot of concerned citizen groups out there now. In fact, one of the things I was doing earlier in the year was running around the country helping organize political action groups who would take information on whether it was fluoride or abuses of in psychiatry or toxins and mercury fogling, like the mercury toxicity, and trying to get groups to protest this in a way that we could seek legislative reform. And so now, this comes from the Sunday Times. And by the way, this is done worldwide. You have to understand, our broadcasts go out on the internet all over the world. If you go to GaryNall.com, right at the beginning as you tune it on, it'll show you where you can pick up this program, and you do not have to hear it live. You can go and you can hear this program. The one I'm doing right now, you can hear this 24 hours a day. And the shows I've done over the last few months, and this all free, is a public service. So anywhere in the world, any time of the day, you can get any of these programs and listen to them. And so that's a new service that we're able to provide. And so now it's not like you have to be at a radio at exactly the time that this show is being heard. And some people, like on Roy of Hollywood, it's very difficult because it's midnight to 6 a.m. on the West Coast. You know, here's what this comes out. I'll quote from Lois Rogers and Rosie Waterhouse. Manufacturers of Prozac and other top-selling antidepressants have been asked to include stronger warnings in their packaging because of fears that the drug could trigger violent behavior. The Committee on Safety of Medicines has also asked to see unpublished data from earlier trials that tested their safety in healthy volunteers after claims that some individuals became violently depressed while taking the antidepressants, who were not depressed before taking them. Ramo Kabani of the Prozac Survivor Support Group, a patients organization, and by the way, just as an aside, we are organizing dozens and dozens of these Prozac Survivor groups around the country right now, and we're also organizing parents with to join Ritalin Survivor groups to try to understand what has occurred to their children being given Ritalin, so that we can seek legislation for parents who are told their kid must take Ritalin or can't go to school, that instead of having their rights challenged as parents, they would have an exemption from taking Ritalin. Anyhow, it is said that it has received more than 2,000, just this one group, 2,300 calls about side effects. Half from people who said they had become suicidal or violent, where they never were before after taking Prozac. That's just one group receiving thousands of calls. So you see, you stir the waters and look what comes up. David Healy, director of the North Psychological Medicine Service in Bangor, is one of a number of the specialists who has published research demonstrating that the SSRIs can induce suicidal feelings in healthy volunteers. Recently, Prozac and Ceradax, the other market leader in manufacturing these tranquilizers by GlaxoSmithKline, has been the subject of a high-profile legal case after claims that people had gone berserk while taking them. Last month, Glaxo paid out $4 million after one of the drugs, Paxil, was blamed for the behavior of Donald Shell, who shot his wife to death, and then daughter and nine-month-old granddaughter, and killed himself. And this was only after he had been prescribed the drug. So, that's good news. At least the message is getting out there. I'm Gary Knoll, and I had an email this morning from a vet. And the vet evidently had seen a program I had done on PBS. And once I give the show to PBS, because I don't sell it, just so people understand how it works. Normally, people go to PBS for funding of a series. And the average series, just a single program, will run about $500,000. That's on the low side. As a, if it's more than one part, it could run $2, $3, $4, $5 million. PBS and other stations and some sponsors will select which programs they're going to fund, and they give a production company the money, and the production company goes out and produces it, and then gives it back to PBS. That whole process could take anywhere from 1 to 3 years or longer. Only a handful of programs ever get that funding. And only a handful of stations really ever end up showing it. What I've done is I've gone ahead and selected the topics that I felt were important based upon people's feedback. And then I produce the specials myself, write them in, direct them in, and host them and produce them. And then use the team that I have in New York that helps and does a good job at that. And then I give it free to PBS stations. They don't pay for anything. They don't even pay when I fly in to help them with the fundraising. And a lot of these stations, most of the people either volunteer or are just paid bare minimum. And they really, really, most of them I've met are very conscientious. And they do it because they have a real desire to see whatever quality information does exist get out to their viewers. And I found them to be extremely nice in the small cities in particular, because no one ever goes to these cities. I will not mention anyone's name, but some very well personalities to go to a city would ask $30,000 fee just to appear, first class air tickets for them in an entourage, be put up in a hotel and limos. And these small stations, an entire budget is only $50,000 for a whole drive. Point of fact, this one radio station one right now that I'm broadcasting from out of New York City, WBAI, our budget is higher than many of the PBS television stations around the country for a similar period. And so they try to get whatever programming they can that's free. But a lot of people just have never, they've never seen anyone. So they're very surprised when they call and say, you know, we need your help. Could you come in and help us raise some funds? I say, sure, and I'll go into these places. And you have to take these little skipper planes, and you look at a cloud formation, they go, and here we go. And you hit that clear air turbulence, and it just bounces all over the place. And then you get in there, and you do the, they say, well, how much, I ask them, how much do you want to raise? And they say, well, you know, our whole budget for the whole day is $5,000. So if you could raise $1,000, that we'd be happy. I think, whoa, you know, Channel 13 in New York is $150 million operating budget. And they're happy for this day if they raise $5,000. What a, you know, what a difference. And that, by the way, that station was Chattanooga, Tennessee. And so you do what you can, and then, but once you give them the tape, they can air it, air it, air it. And they do, and I never know who's airing what at any given time. I've been all over the place, so I could have seven different shows. I've produced seven different programs. I'm working on my eighth right now. In fact, we just finished filming the eighth one about 3 weeks ago before I left on this trip. Many of you were in the audience, and that was a fun night. This is going to be the best ever. It's really upbeat, positive, and most importantly, the entire program is about looking at how we get sick and how we get well by people who've done it. Very, very inspiring stories where we flew all over the country and filmed these people in their journey to wellness. You can't help but watch this without kind of getting goosebumps and thinking, whoa, when you see how far down these people were and where they are today. In any case, and that'll be airing in December, premiering in December. In any case, one of the shows I did was on natural pet care, and it aired. This vet sends me this really angry letter. It's about 5 pages long. It goes into great detail about how, if anything, pets are not vaccinated enough. They need actually more vaccines, and it's vaccines that have caused the health and well-being of cats and dogs and other animals, and it's irresponsible of me to suggest that these vaccines are either overused or shouldn't be used. And he said, I shouldn't even be allowed on the air for saying this. He said, okay, that's his perspective. That's fine. I started to think about it. How many other individuals love their pet and do whatever the vet says, including giving them all these mandatory or yearly vaccinations? Without ever asking him a simple question, could you show me the scientific evidence to support that by giving this vaccine, it will help prevent a disease from occurring in my pet? And if you did say that, they would be hard put to find the studies, because what the vet may not be aware of is I don't just come out and make some statement unless I have some basis, having studied the literature. And that's exactly what I did. I studied the scientific literature on this subject to ask the same question. By the way, it's no different than the question I asked for the vaccines for humans. And I didn't see the evidence. Then I began to speak with many vets. And I asked the vets, over 30 different vets, top vets from Cornell and around the country, can you show me peer-reviewed literature that by giving my cat or dog these particular mandated vaccines that will A, do no harm, and B, protect them? And they look at you. And for a moment, they're inclined to say, well, of course. And they think, well, I've never really looked myself, they say. I say, why don't we look together? And then they get the surprise of their life. Imagine your doctor saying, today you'll be getting vaccinated for measles, mumps, rubella, smallpox, hepatitis, and tetanus. Oh, and while you're here, why not get your flu shot as well? If you're a member of this audience, you'd probably drop your jaw in disbelief. Yet many people think nothing is subjecting their companion animals to multiple vaccinations year after year. Our puppies and kittens start life with 4 or more initial shots, followed by a 5-in-1 or 7-in-1 booster each year for the next 15 years of their lives. Animals are vaccinated and revaccinated against a whole slew of conditions far more than we humans are. This use or overuse of vaccine, to me, is a great cause of concern. Not just the alternative, but the conventional veterinary community, as well as others, now link overzealous vaccination protocols to a number of problems. And one particularly disturbing side effect is a kind of fibrosarcoma, an aggressive vaccine-induced tumor, sometimes seen in cats following a rabies or feline leukemia vaccine. Now, the condition name vaccinoma develops at the injection site at about 0.7% of vaccinated cats, which is an unacceptably large percentage considering the severity of the disease. I interviewed Dr. Dennis Macy, professor of oncology at Colorado State University, estimates at 22,000 such cases in the mid-1990s, and found that more cancer developed where vaccines were repeatedly given at a particular site over time. In addition to cancer, many veterinarians believe that chronic degenerative disease, including heart disease, thyroid disorder, skin problems, intestinal disease, and arthritis, are at times associated with vaccinations. In recent years, conventional veterinarians have become increasingly aware of the problem stemming from over-vaccination. A leading professional publication, in fact, the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association, has been reporting on the controversy in one article entitled, "Are We Vaccinating Too Much?" Several veterinarian experts conclude that the need for annual parvovirus and distemper boosters has not been established whatsoever, and that the practice of administering weekly parvo vaccine to young puppies is unnecessary and harmful. Fortunately, a new trend in veterinary medicine is to vaccinate less frequently. Instead of automatically revaccinating each year, some doctors are choosing to inoculate animals every 3 years. Veterinary organization guidelines are changing. Veterinary teaching hospitals at Colorado State University and the University of California, Davis, for example, are encouraging veterinarians to vaccinate adult dogs against rabies, parvovirus, adenovirus, parainfluenza, and distemper every 3 years instead of every year. And additionally, the American Veterinary Medical Association is reconsidering annual vaccine guidelines, and the American Association of Feline Practitioners already encourages the three-year approach. Now, these new official guidelines, combined with an insistent, knowledgeable public that demands greater caution, could influence more veterinarians to be conservative. Now, I would suggest that they look at the homeopathic view. Homeopathic medicine finds that the whole concept of vaccination, as it is conventionally understood, is problematic. This is a point of view worth examining. In allopathic medicine, vaccines are believed to immunize against disease by imitating the disease process. With the introduction of a weakened or attenuated or killed virus or bacteria into the body, the immune system is fooled into producing protective TMB cells against the foreign invaders. In the event of a future exposure to the virus or bacteria, the cells are supposed to remember their former encounter and respond by producing appropriate antibodies against the disease. But the homeopathic would argue that the conventional vaccine does not guarantee protection and that it may not help at all. Actually, the only way to truly establish lifelong immunity is to survive a disease. Rather than protect, vaccines interfere with the living organism's vital energy, a force called qi, or vital life force. The disease symptoms may be suppressed only to resurface years later with a greater vengeance or to manifest as some other disease. And many believe, for instance, that the deadly parvovirus is a mutation of feline distemper, another fatal disease, because it first appeared shortly after the widespread inoculation against distemper. Homeopaths attribute lifelong problems to conventionally practiced vaccines. The term of this vaccine-induced illness is vaccinosis. Vaccinating a dog against canine distemper, for example, may suppress acute symptoms of the disease, such as vomiting, diarrhea, and loss of appetite, but at the same time initiate chronic gastritis, hepatitis, pancreatitis, and appetite disorders. And similarly, Administering a rabies vaccine may foster the continual expression of restlessness, uneasiness, apprehensiveness, and viciousness characteristic of the disease. You will not see the original disease, distemper or rabies, but you will now have distemper vaccinosis or rabies vaccinosis, chronic vaccine-related illnesses. This is not to say that you should forego vaccinating your pet for these particular diseases, but do so with an understanding of the consequence. In some instances, vaccinosis may even contribute to death from the disease a vaccine was designed to prevent. When a vaccine creates a chronic illness in an animal or a person who is highly susceptible to the disease, a later exposure to the natural form of the disease may result in the natural disease combining forces with the established disease to create an illness more life-threatening than the original illness. When vaccinosis is present, treating symptoms of a disease homeopathically may fail unless the original cause of the problem, the vaccination, is first treated. Now, and I'll try to explain how this works. Homeopathic physicians believe that problems arise because of the way vaccines are given. When you inject a virus or bacteria, you bypass the body's natural filtration mechanism. Usually the mouth and respiratory system are the first lines of defense against communicable disease. In fact, there was an article called The Case Against Vaccination by Dr. Richard Moskowitz, an MD, who argues that when we vaccinate, we short-circuit these very important primary responses to disease. He explains that by cheating the body in this fashion, we have accomplished precisely what the evolution of the immune system seems to have been designed to prevent. We have placed the virus directly into the bloodstream and given it free and immediate access to the major immune organs and tissues without any obvious way of getting rid of it. Well, vaccines introduce substances in addition to viruses or bacteria that the body must now fight off. They contain antibiotics and fungicides used to protect the vaccine against bacterial contamination, aluminum sulfate and mercuric oxide added to carry viral particles into the body in the injection procedure, and also the medium in which the vaccine is grown, such as chick embryos or fetal bovine serum. That enters the body and can trigger adverse reactions. So looking at the big picture, many homeopaths wonder whether the widespread use of conventional vaccines is suppressing natural disease to such a degree that it will have serious consequences to the health of future generations. I have always felt that the attempt to eradicate entire microbial species from the biosphere must inevitably upset the balance of nature in fundamental ways that we have yet to imagine. Just look at nosodes. In the ongoing controversy surrounding vaccination for pets, some members of the anti-vaccine side have advocated what are called nosodes as an alternative. Now, nosodes are homeopathic remedies that have been made from a diseased agent or from tissue that has been affected by a specific disease. For example, a nosode of parvovirus would originate in a bit of a dog's intestine that's been infected by the virus, while the raw material of a heartworm nosode is actual heartworm larvae. Now, these samples have been diluted to the point where there are no viral particles left in the nosode solution itself, only the molecular energy memory of what it was there before. Now, the nosodes are not really an acceptable alternative to all vaccines, but it's certainly one that can make a big difference in those that you don't want to overstimulate the immune system of your pet, and you certainly don't want to introduce an active viral or bacteria into their system, so this is an option. Are there studies on this? No. But there's an awful lot of clinical experience. The only studies done so far are conducted in England, and one nosode trial conducted in the U.S. against parvovirus, and one of the most lethal diseases that can strike dogs, showed that the nosodes did protect the puppies in the trial against the disease. But this one case study alone does not constitute enough evidence to make generalizations about the use of nosodes. Then questions about whether these substances as an alternative vaccines are still acceptable. And anecdotally, there are cases where people have treated dogs with nosodes instead of vaccines, and the dogs have not gotten sick. But in such uncontrolled circumstances, there's no way of knowing whether the dogs were actually exposed to the disease that the nosodes were intended to protect against. However, there's another way to use nosodes that have been proven effective. These substances may be administered to a dog or cat before or after vaccinating it as a preventative against the adverse reactions to the vaccine. Now, in these circumstances, the use of nosodes is entirely safe and runs virtually no risk of side effects. And they can also be administered after a dog is known to have been exposed to a disease such as parvo. And in the case where it is administered, it's been known to help the dog's conditions. And that can be in lieu of using a vaccine. So for those who have suggested that there is no question that vaccines are necessary and safe, I would say there's no literature to support that. At the same time, where possibly a rabies vaccine is important, you should test the titers to make sure that there's still active titers in the blood before revaccinating. And sometimes a single injection can last the entire lifetime of the pet. I can only tell you that from my experience, the more you vaccinate your pet, the more likely that pet's going to die of some disease far, far sooner than what it would have. So I see the type and amount of vaccines we're giving as being extremely destructive. And there's virtually an epidemic of cancer in dogs right now. And it's not just the purebreds from overbreeding. It's also because the massive amount of vaccines that we're including in their regimen. And whether or not to vaccinate is an individual decision. And it's a difficult choice, as it is with humans. And but look at all the literature that's out there. And I have a lot on vaccinations of both humans and animals on my webpage. And it's there as a public service, so take advantage of it. And one of the things you can do is you can also, if you are in a situation where you're forced to vaccinate, okay, but then there are remedies you can take that can help detoxify the body's effect from vaccines, both in humans and in animals. And I'm going to be doing a program in the next few weeks when I return to New York on how to undo the damage done from a vaccine. So I'm working on that now. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go to the calls and see who we have on the line. Say hello and what the issues are you'd like to address. Hi, what's your name, please? You're on the air.
Oh, boy.
Just speak right up.
Hello?
Yes.
Gary?
Yes.
Oh, Gary, thanks for taking my call. Gary, is there any way I could find out the name and the number of the doctor you had on yesterday? We couldn't get it. We listened to the whole thing. It was very good.
Okay, I'm sorry, but I don't even know who I had on yesterday. The show was not live yesterday because I was not able to do a connection.
Oh.
When I'm out on the road, and especially when I'm in another country like Cuba or off to South Africa, I can't be sure I can make a connection, so I leave a series of tapes with the station that they can play that you haven't heard before. And I have about 20 such programs there, so I honestly don't know. And my the person who handles my archive, Sharon Pride, is out this week on vacation.
Oh, I see.
What I would do is wait 1 week, and
yes,
next week call my office in New York, ask for Sharon Pride, ask her about yesterday's program, and she could then give you the person's name and contact number, okay?
Oh, that's good.
Okay.
Gary, I just wanted to ask you something about myself, please.
Sure.
Excuse me. I'm 86 years old. And I was in the hospital about 3 weeks ago. I had diverticulosis and bleeding a lot. And I developed ulcers and hemorrhoids. And I was pretty sick. I was in the hospital for 3 or 4 days. And now I stopped all the vitamins because I was bleeding so badly. And now I'm trying to get back on the vitamins, but I don't know. You know, if I'm doing anything right or wrong by getting back onto them, I'm trying to get back gradually. But I have cataracts, and I had a stroke in my left eye, so I'm blind in my left eye. And now the right eye has cataracts, and I'm afraid to go to have it operated because the doctor said I may lose the sight altogether. So I think some of the vitamins that I was taking helped my eye, and now I seem to be getting worse. Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, sure. The good news, there's always something positive we can do no matter what. I would look at it a little differently. You're 86 years of age, right?
Yes.
Okay. There's a woman, her name is Pat, and she is, I believe she just turned 80. She had far worse conditions than you because she had seven life-challenging. In fact, she had been given a terminal sentence. Today, a year and a half since I saw her, she's totally well. Emphysema's gone, arthritis is gone, fibromyalgia's gone, she's lost over 100 pounds, she was wheelchair with oxygen all day, all the 22 medications all gone. I will tell you the same thing I told her. When she gave me the list of all the conditions she had, it was like 22 conditions, you know, like one's worse than the other, congestive heart failure. Don't look at the conditions. Because you're talking about ulcers, diverticulitis, cataracts, and I'm quite sure there's many other things you could add on to that, correct?
Yes, I have a severe scoliosis and arthritis and osteoporosis, and my spine is twisted that it brought my left hip up, and now my left leg is shorter, so I'm having a big problem trying to...
Okay, but what I'm going to ask you is this.
Yes.
Here is the approach I would take. Don't look at any of those conditions.
Yes.
Instead, just look at the fact that all those conditions are in part due to the body being toxic.
Oh.
So the very first step in helping any of those conditions would be to detoxify the body. By cleansing the body, you're helping all those conditions. Otherwise, if you know, I could help you with an ulcerated colitis by telling about proteolytic enzymes and pancreatin and acidophilus and chiodophilus and glutamine and vitamin A. And you say, wow, that's a lot of nutrients. But that really won't make a difference.
I'm taking most
if
of those.
If you continue to have anything in your system that could be contributing to the local inflammatory process.
Mm.
So what we have to do is we have to turn off all the ways in which your body creates local inflammation.
Mm.
In fact, this is as true for cancer as it is for congestive heart failure or arthritis or fibromyalgia. All of these have local inflammatory processes that contribute to their progression. So the question is, what are you doing that's causing this? And then you have to take a real honest look at virtually everything in your life. If you have any wheat, you have to eliminate it in any form. Because that's a contributing factor, because the gluten to ulcerative colitis or diverticulitis, no sugars. No artificial sweeteners. You have to eliminate dairy because that will contribute to your osteoporosis.
I see.
And also contributes to arthritis. It's a lysed cell. It's a throw-off cell of the cow. And there's no place for it in a human body. And it's generally highly infective. So you don't want something that's that infective in your body because your body is already infected.
Mm.
You don't want to, if you've got a really bad bruise on your arm, you don't want someone coming up and hitting you on the arm.
Right.
No matter how lightly, it's still going to be painful. So you want to get rid of caffeine, sugar, dairy, meat, any processed foods, fried foods. You can have none of that, not even a morsel.
And I'm a meat eater.
Now, do you understand that? Do you understand the first step?
Yes.
Okay, now do you understand when I say you can have none, that means zero?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, that's the first step. Ready for the second step. Second step is that we now have to go on an elimination program that allows the body a chance to cleanse. First, we turn off the inflammation process by stopping foods or beverages that would cause that to occur. Then we want to start some cleansing. In effect, it's like you don't build a new house on an old, rotted-out foundation. You first have to go in there and you have to clean it out. And this whole process is going to take you about, at the earliest, a year. It may take you a little longer, but be patient, because the rewards could be a pain-free body with great range of motion and endurance and strength and stamina that you haven't experienced in years. The inflammation is a natural reaction to any infection or injury, but most of it you can't see because it's internal. It can be bacterial, it can be viral, and that in turn leads to arthritis, allergies, and all the conditions that you have. Vitamin C is the single most important nutrient for turning off local inflammatory processes.
Yes.
Bioflavonoids are the catalyst that allow vitamin C to be used. They're essential in healing and reducing inflammation. So you want to make sure that you get your vitamin C in buffered form 5 times a day. Now you'll start at a low dose, something that you can handle, and always have it with a meal, even a small little meal, or like a protein shake, a 6-ounce protein shake with about, at your age, 5 grams of protein. That's not much, but it's enough to allow the vitamin C to be buffered and for you to utilize it and to keep your blood sugar level up, and so you'll have energy. And also, if the protein is from a vegetable protein, it's pre-digested, so it doesn't tax your immune system, doesn't tax your digestive system, doesn't tax your allergy system, doesn't tax your digestive system. So you're getting your quality protein, and that gives you strength. And also, your immune system is made in no small measure by these proteins. So that's important.
Mm-hmm.
The bioflavonoids are going to start turning off the pain in your joints. And generally, you'll start at, let's say, 500 milligrams of vitamin C and 150 to 200 milligrams of bioflavonoids 5 times a day. And then after 2 or 3 weeks, even a month, increase it. Maybe 700 milligrams. Then after a couple more months, increase it, 1,000 milligrams. The idea is you want to keep building up the amount of vitamin C.
But doesn't that...
You also want to take zinc. Zinc's helps to control inflammation and promotes healing. So we want to start the healing of the joints, healing of the digestive tract, healing of the intestine, and especially where you have all those little diverticular pockets.
Well,
so we want to heal that.
Copper, don't you, Gary?
30 milligrams of zinc a day.
I see.
We also want you to take bromelain. B-R-O-M-E-L-A-I-N. Bromelain.
Yes, I have bromelain.
Now, bromelain at about, anywhere from 100 to 500 milligrams. That's important. You should take it on an empty stomach because it really is a great anti-inflammatory.
Mm-hmm.
And it increases the breakdown of fibrin, which forms around the inflamed areas, blocking the blood and lymphatic vessels and leading to the swelling. Now, I'm sure you have swelling in your joints, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, that swelling is due to this fibrin.
All my joints.
And we want to turn off the fibrin and break it down, have the body reabsorb it and digest it. So bromelain helps you digest fibrin, which then helps reduce the swelling. Are you up with me?
Yes.
Understanding what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay. Then garlic.
Gary, with the zinc.
I'd like for you to take...
Gary, with the zinc, you
do you
need
like
copper,
to eat garlic?
Don't you?
Pardon me?
With the zinc, you need some copper, don't you?
I'm going to get to that. I'm doing one thing at a time here. Do you eat garlic?
Well, now I haven't been because they put me on a diet from the diverticulosis.
Okay.
I can't say the word.
No one else can. You're not alone. Don't worry about it. Garlic capsules, then.
Garlic capsules?
2 capsules 3 times a day with meals.
Yes.
Now, that garlic in there will help lower your blood pressure, lower your cholesterol, lower your triglycerides. Most importantly, it helps turn off inflammatory processes in your intestine and in your blood.
Mm-hmm.
Silica, S-I-L, S-I-L-I-C-A.
Yes.
Now, silica aids the absorption of calcium, repairs your connective tissue, and helps you with your arthritis and osteoporosis. I'd like to see you take calcium and magnesium from citrate, about 1,000 milligrams of each, and you take this in the late afternoon. Calcium and magnesium from citrate.
Oh, the late afternoon then.
Bilberry.
Yes.
B-I-L-B-E-R-R-Y. It contains flavonoids.
Yes.
Which help reduce your inflammation. Red clover is a tea. Yucca, Y-U-C-C-A.
Yes.
Both of those turn off flames. I'm trying to use things that you could easily get that are inexpensive, that are non-hassle. Now, if you take a multiple vitamin that has copper, 2 milligrams of copper is fine. Now, that's your basic, plus aloe vera.
Yes.
That's your basic protocol. The aloe vera will help your stomach with the ulcers. It'll help your intestine with the diverticulitis. It'll help the immune system for all conditions, from cancer to viruses and bacteria. It's one of the best. In fact, it is the single best healing herb there is. Garlic is under it, but it's right at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take that aloe about 3 to 4 times a day. Now, you should also get yourself into the hands of a really good chiropractor who will work with your scoliosis and your hip to realign the hip. And,
yes.
And until he does so, a good chiropractor will give you information on how you can get some heel pads that can bring up and compensate for the displacement of the hips.
Yes, I had to have shoes made
now,
because the left shoe.
If you take some
highest.
Vegetable juice, and do you have a juice extractor?
No, I don't.
Okay, do you have a blender?
Yes, I have a blender.
Good. I'd like for you to have a glass of fresh tomato juice, and you can put, if you like, cayenne, that's very good for healing also, some spices that you like in there.
Yes.
With some celery, cucumber, that's excellent also. It helps reduce inflammation and swelling. And I want you to have that, a big glass of that, and drink it throughout the day. A glass, a fresh glass of tomato juice each day. Now,
okay.
You can do that, can't you?
Yes.
Okay. And you can have fish, broil fish.
Yes.
Baked fish. Just don't deep fry it. You can have all the salads you want, beans and grains, and try to get them organic wherever possible.
Yes.
And that starts the process. Now, that's only the first step. When I get back to New York, I'll be doing a special workshop, I don't know when yet, for senior citizens on starting their recovery. It's not a whole health support program, but it is one afternoon I'm going to spend about 6-7 hours just taking senior citizens on this, getting them started and giving them the tools they need, and maybe in 6 months meet with them again, see how they're doing.
Okay.
But at least that would get you started. So I think you can do all those things, can't you?
Yes, I'll try, Gary.
Lots of water every day.
Yes.
I'd like to see you drink about a gallon of water a day.
Oh, Gary, the other day you said drink a gallon of water and a teaspoon of something. What was the something? You said a gallon of water and a teaspoon.
Flaxseed oil.
Oh, the flaxseed oil?
Mm-hmm.
Separate from the water, though, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a total gallon of liquid a day. That would include factor in your juices. All right. All the best to you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Gary.
You have a nice day. Bye. Let's see who else we have on the phone. Hi, I'm Gary. Your turn. What's your name, please?
Hello, my name is Jonathan.
Hi, Jonathan.
Oh, Gary, it's an honor and a privilege to talk to you. I only have a few minutes, so I just want to say that I'm hoping that somewhere in the future you might be able to talk about Sarcoid I had song coin for the last 10 years, and it devastated me and brutalized me. It was a very serious thing in the African-American community. Also, a lot of Scandinavians get it, and it's just as bad as multiple sclerosis. I think more people have song coin than multiple sclerosis, and I'm hoping that maybe one day in the future you might be able to do a show on that. And also, what are we going to do about the thing about when people say that the problem with the health food industry is that you can't, there's no standards. That's why people don't want to take the herbs, because you say, take flaxseed oil. Well, different manufacturers have different standards. Well, what are we saying about that?
That's actually not true if they do say that. If you were to contact the Herbal Research Foundation and speak with the director of it, I believe it's McCalb. I'm not sure if he's still the director or not. They do have a list of the standards necessary for an herb to have efficacy, and they will then be able to give you a list of the companies that have very strict standards in how they produce their actual product. Give you an example. I was doing a filming about 3 months ago, and I was out in Long Island at a plant, I won't mention the plant, and they're in a humongous hangar. It was the size of a airplane craft hangar. Mm-hmm. There were gigantic bales, bundle bales of herbs,
right,
from all over the world. I'm going to say there were 5,000 of them,
right,
and they probably were about 7 feet long, 5 feet high, 5 feet wide. And as the bales came in from Uganda or Tanzania or Ethiopia, where they came from,
right,
and they're all handcrafted, they would look at it and then they would see, all right, we asked for echinacea. They would then take a sample. They would take it into a multi-million-dollar on-site pharmacy and compare it on a computer.
Right.
If it matched, then it was allowed to go into quarantine, where it would be tested for bacteria, fungus, molds, or anything else that might be harmful.
That's good to know.
And, by the way, at any point that it did not meet these standards, it's destroyed. Mm-hmm. Then, at that point, it was then analyzed for its potency, because it's not always just, you know, the root. It might be the leaf, or it might be the stem, it might be the bark. So they had to actually see, is the active biological ingredient here and in what amount? And I watched as they did all these different tests, 66 separate tests, and then they did the non-alcohol ferment, and then they did the quantum assays, and the final product that came out at the end of this one company was as good as it gets. And I filmed that just because I was wanting to challenge this notion of these quackbusters and the FDA and the pharmaceutical companies now that are running around wanting us not to take herbs because of, quote, they're unqualified, there are no standards. And that's simply a lie. It's an out-and-out lie. And this is a part of a documentary I'm doing on the attack of our health freedoms and our freedom of choice by misinformation that leads us then to question the safety or efficacy of something. I just wanted to show them. By the way, this was just a typical place. This was not the best or the most unique. So there are standards, and these are strict standards, and there is safety concern. There's a lot of time and attention paid, but we're led to believe that somehow when you buy an herb, it's bought off the back of someone's Volkswagen and, you know, put into a capsule in their basement and smuggled into a health food store. So we become the unwitting victims. Not true. We're out of time. Thank you all very much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow. You'll have a nice day.